The speaker that we're going to have is a very eloquent speaker. He's an author, and he's going to give us some insights about what happened during the case, for what happened, you know, the inside story. And he can come out of the closet more about it now that he has dropped the lawsuit against Metro. We were devastated that the family was felt forced to not pursue the lawsuit, and he gave a very good reason. So Motorcycle Mondays is specific to the challenges that motorcyclists have, and what I do is I have spyware, and I go around Las Vegas with controversial headgear, and in Nevada is a helmet state. So when I get pulled over, and by the way, I open carry also, and at almost every encounter that I have where I'm open carrying and a cop is encountering me, I make sure I say the name Eric Scott. You know, things like, why are you afraid of me? Didn't you learn something after having murdered Eric Scott? So I mess with them, and I kind of rub it in their face at every opportunity I get, because I'll tell you, that whole experience with Eric Scott really got me to continue to awaken and deprogram myself. And I'm still a little bit programmed, and I still am somewhat of a sheeple. And every day almost, I see where I can be growing and where I need to detoxify my belief systems. So what I do on Motorcycle Mondays is whenever I get pulled over by a cop, I record that, and then I download little clips, and I'm trying to get me a nice co-host that will help me dissect the information. I started one where I was detained by two pigs from the city of North Las Vegas. I was riding my motorcycle, and I had my gun on and my controversial headgear, and I was pulled over, and they forced me to put my hands on the bumper of their car, and they were very, very pissed off, I guess is the word, that I dared to exercise my rights. And without further ado, let me present my special guest. He is the author of a book that is still in progress, and it's a free book, and you can see it on thepermit.blogspot.com. My guest tonight was rudely awakened to fascism in America. Please don't. Bill Scott he's a consultant, author, and former Air Force flight test engineer. His son, Eric Scott, was murdered by Sheriff Douglas Gestapo Gillespie's regime. Gillespie is the sheriff for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Under his watch, the regime has killed more innocent people than any other comparatively sized community in the U.S., and his drones are literally getting away with murder. So I am unmuting Bill Scott, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, Bill. Thank you for coming to Tiger Lily's Freedom Roar Show.
Well, thank you for having me back, Lily. It's great to be on your show again.
I read all of, you know, you've got 8 chapters on there, and it's really an absolute page turner. I was reading it. I just couldn't stop, you know, as I was preparing for this show and stuff. And I have a few comments that I want to make before we get into the book. Of course, I'm very disappointed about you having to drop the lawsuit against Metro, and I understand why. But what bothers me is, have I asked you this? Where was the NRA in Eric Scott's case? Because you start the book with the you know, it's a fiction book, and you start it with basically Trevon Coles, like a simulation of Trevon Coles' case. And Trevon Cole, for you folks listening that are not in the Las Vegas area, he is a black man who was murdered in front of his pregnant wife, and he was basically flushing a doobie down the toilet, but it was a botched raid. And the NAACP and the ACLU got all on top, and they made a big stink, and they got the family got $1.7 million. Now, why Eric Scott wasn't violating any law? He didn't even have a doobie, for heaven's sakes, and he absolutely did nothing wrong. The only thing was the fact that he was armed, but he was lawfully armed. So where was the NRA to speak up for Eric Scott, Bill?
That's a good question, Lily, and I don't have an answer for that. We did contact the NRA. We contacted their legal arm and asked for assistance, you know, with paying for expert witnesses, that sort of thing. And they said they would provide $1,500, $1,500. Well, that won't even buy airfare for an expert to fly in to testify. Basically, I had to come to the conclusion that the NRA is much more focused on activities within what I call that 40 square miles we call Washington, D.C., surrounded by reality. So they just aren't paying attention to a lot of things that are going on out here. That's my impression so far. Now, will they get involved later? I don't know. I'm a little worried that the NRA bought the narrative that Las Vegas Metro put out. And as we know, many of the things that they claimed happened that involved my son Eric just simply were not true. So they went through
right.
this elaborate, very sloppy cover-up. And unfortunately, I think organizations like the NRA said, well, if that's the case, maybe we don't want to get involved. But so that has a lot to do with why I decided to write their permit, this fiction book, based on the real events of Eric's case. So I think you had some questions, though.
Yes, it is just a page-turner, Bill. It is so good. You are a published writer, and what have you published in the past?
Well, as you said, I was a flight test engineer and tested airplanes for about 12 years, but always loved to write. So I wound up joining Aviation Week and Space Technology Magazine. So I was a writer, reporter, and, you know, pilot, flight reporter, et cetera, for Aviation Week for 22 years. So I did a lot of professional writing there. And then along the way, I did write one book back in the early 90s with a co-author that was nonfiction called Inside the Stealth Bomber, the B-2 Story. And then in recent years, with co-authors, I wrote two fiction books, two novels, one called Space Wars, The First 6 Hours of World War III, and then the sequel was Counter Space, The Next Hours of World War III. Really enjoy writing fiction, and that seemed to be the best way to go with the permit for reasons that I can go over later. Over to you.
Well, right, and my husband actually, you know, I asked him, do you want me to read this really juicy stuff? And he did, and he said the first initial reaction of his was, wow, that must have been very cathartic for Bill to write that, because it's like it's a release. Is that how you felt writing the book?
Yes, that was one of the reasons why I decided to write this book. You might say that anger needs a voice. And, of course, there was a tremendous amount of anger because Eric was killed for, as you said, absolutely no reason. It was a totally senseless, botched thing. The whole incident should never have happened, and in the real world it would not have happened. But it was a confluence of anti-gun sentiment, anti-gun policies in Costco, where Eric was, and he was concealed carrying legally. But they have a policy at Costco of no guns in the store. But it's a catch-22 policy. They don't post any signs that say no firearms allowed in the store. And if you fill out an application to become a member, which Eric did that day, he bought a $100 executive membership, nowhere on the application does it say anything about no firearms. And at one time, Costco admitted in court that they don't notify people of their no-gun policy because they, quote, didn't want to irritate their NRA members. Well, it's a catch-22. Mm-hmm. So when Eric became
right.
uncovered, once somebody saw the gun, they panicked, they called the cops, and it went downhill from there. And the bottom line is cops start screaming at Eric, and he said things like, get on the ground, drop it, three conflicting orders. Eric only had a BlackBerry cell phone in his hand. The idiot cop thought it was a gun, and fired. Now, all this happened within 2 seconds. 2 seconds. From the time the cops started screaming, yep. Eric had to make a 180 turn, assess the situation, try to figure out which of the three conflicting commands to acknowledge, and then the cop shot him in the heart because he thought the BlackBerry in Eric's hand was a gun. This guy was an idiot. Unfortunately, my son died because an idiot was scared to death. So, yes,
what a bunch of cowards.
It's good therapy for my son, my other son, Kevin, and me, and Kevin's been involved in the plot line, et cetera. So, you know, I could do in fiction what I could never do in reality. And really wanted to write a book that is far more than just a book about vengeance. It is a much broader story that I'll go over in a minute. But I would like to think that it's a message to a crooked Metro Police Department and their cops and the public officials that go along with them and aid and abet them all the time to send the message that you will be held accountable for killing Eric and many of the other innocent citizens. And frankly, you cops will suffer more for your lies and cover-up than you ever would have if you just simply admitted that you screwed up in the first place. And finally, the real lesson of the permit, and maybe we got this backwards here, but the real lesson for Las Vegas Metro cops, from the sheriff and his tower minions right down to the low-life idiot cops who killed my son, this message is that there are forces of good out there, and they are far more powerful than your forces of evil. And the good forces will destroy you at some point, Metro. So, the permit may be fiction, but I like to think it's a loud and clear warning to every crooked politician, cop, judge, lawyer, and resort hotel billionaire puppet master that your time is over. And the beginning of the end for you is when Mosier, Mendiola, and Stark murdered Eric Scott. This time, the cartel of corruption really did kill the wrong guy.
Absolutely. And let me just make this comment also that you said that they cover up and lie and everything, and the story is about Metro, Las Vegas Metro. But what I see here, Bill, is really this is not just about Las Vegas. This is happening all across the country. And there are just cases after cases, you know, Teresa Smith, her case, and there's just countless cases where cops are murdering people and getting away with it. How I don't see how that happens. And as far as your comment about how, you know, they, instead of just coming clean and apologizing, they make your son out to be some kind of a villain and attempt to ruin his reputation, and they will stop at nothing in order to cover their own sorry asses. And when I was a nurse, I used to hate doctors because doctors were so arrogant. They thought they were God, and I never thought I'd find a profession that I disliked more. But I found it within the law enforcement profession. And doctors have a website. There's a website that when I was a nurse that I used to subscribe to, which is called SorryWorks.org, I think, and. And I can't tell you how many times patients who were wrongly treated by a doctor, if the doctor had good bedside manners and apologized, the likelihood that they would even be sued was almost nil compared to if the doctor tries to cover up and then blame the patient. And that's what's going on here. The arrogance, I can't comprehend the arrogance of Gillespie and his ilk, and like you said, all the people around him. It's just one corrupt cesspool down there.
Yeah, I call it like a five-legged stool that together makes up this cartel of corruption. And in Southern Nevada, which is primarily Las Vegas, it comprises the political, the law enforcement, the judicial, commercial, and the union labor sectors of that whole society. And together, they've been doing this for so many years, Lily, that they think they control the community and they can do whatever they please. So together, using the cops as the enforcers for the mafia, basically, there that runs everything, they routinely abuse, beat, kill, as if they have a permit. They have a permit to kill, do whatever they want with no restrictions. But the lesson that they haven't learned yet is when you think you're the biggest dog on the block, that's when you discover there's always a bigger dog than you are. Now, that's one of the themes of the permit. And again, the permit is fiction, but it's based on the real events. So in the permit, the bigger dog is a federal agency that's so classified, nobody will even acknowledge it exists. And that's what we call the black world. Now, that's something I covered as a reporter for years, and frankly, I was part of the black world back when I was in the Air Force and had clearances, security clearances that didn't know what they were good for because I worked at the National Security Agency. So black means that it doesn't officially exist. It's off the books. So in the permit, that agency is called Checkmate, and it's a completely covert, unacknowledged unit that's part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Now, Checkmate's mission, and this is fictional, is to find and eliminate domestic terrorist sleeper cells before they can attack and kill Americans on U.S. soil. Now, the head of Checkmate is a retired U.S. Marine Corps two-star general that I call Gray Manor. And he recruited a unique team of covert agents that are tasked with eliminating these terrorist sleeper cells by using highly advanced technologies and weapon systems. And my fictional victim was Eric Steele, not Eric Scott, but Eric Steele. Right. He was one of those agents. And the Las Vegas cops screwed up royally when they shot Eric, and they had no idea that he was a Checkmate agent. But that was the straw that broke the camel's back, because when they went into their cover-up mode to cover up Eric's killing, and you say, why would they do that? It's, well, because in Las Vegas, that's what they always do. They always cover it up.
Because they can.
Because they can. And they've got a system down that we won't get into here, but it's a very well-oiled system. And when we were able to start disrupting that system called the coroner's inquest process, and a lot of activists like you, Lily, helped ram through changes there in Vegas, well, then the cops went berserk, and the stupid, arrogant police union there has managed through legal machinations to put the inquest process on hold indefinitely. Well, again, they think they've got it all covered, but I guarantee you they don't. Because even though it's standard operating procedure for Las Vegas Metro, with the help, by the way, of the district attorney that's just as corrupt, public administrator that aided and abetted the break-in of my son's condo to steal two guns in order to make their narrative work out, but you throw in the judicial, political, and the most arrogant, worthless bunch of all, in my estimation, is the Las Vegas Police Protective Association. You've really got a cesspool there, as you said. But in the book, the Las Vegas cops that killed Eric, in so doing, they signed their own death warrants. That act of blatant murder was the last straw, as I said, for Checkmate and the Department of Homeland Security. And they have determined that throughout the entire United States, since the 9/11 attacks, the most deadly, the most serious threat to American freedom is an entirely new, homegrown domestic terrorist, rogue or bad cops. And you say, there's a few bad cops on every department. No, not so much anymore. Bad cops now constitute 25% to 30% of many big city police departments, including Las Vegas, and that's by the estimate of their own good cops. Many of the good cops in Las Vegas refuse to work with these 25% to 30% that they consider rogue, because they said they're dangerous and they're just terrible cops. They are actually killers, and they're criminals. So throughout the United States, bad cops have killed more Americans than Al-Qaeda has since 9/11 on U.S.
soil. Wow.
Today, Lily, police abuse is literally an epidemic, and it's throughout America, just as you said. And you say, well, wait a minute, I haven't heard much about that. Well, the national news media rarely reports on widespread police abuse. The locals do. But, you know, there's nobody that keeps track of how many officer-involved shootings and killings there are all over the United States. And part of it is it's because we the sheeple,
yep.
we want to believe that most cops are good. It's very uncomfortable to think that the very people who are supposed to protect us are the terrorists, that they are our own worst enemy at times. So unfortunately, with today, about a third of today's cops that are nothing more than criminals and killers with a badge, what do you do about it? Well, most Americans are resistant to even hearing that truth, that cops abuse, kill, and cover up their crimes, so it's very difficult to convince them. So that's why you don't hear much about it on the news. You don't see too many nonfiction books about it, film documentaries, TV shows that are telling Americans that we do have a serious problem with killer cops, I call them. And these are the most dangerous domestic terrorist threat to Americans today are our own cops that should never have been given a badge and a gun. So that's why I chose to write The Permit as a fictional story based on the actual events that surrounded my son's murder by cop. Only by putting the facts in the context of a techno-thriller story will people hopefully understand a number of today's truths. And with your permission, I'll run through these. The new generation of police officer is drastically different than the older cops. So you have to make that distinction. The new ones, and I consider the new ones to be those that are in the 18 to 38-year-old range. It's hard to believe that a kid right out of high school can be made a full-fledged cop, but it happens in Vegas all the time. So these new ones were literally raised on video games. So for the first time in American history, we have a batch of cops that have been shooting and killing bad guys and aliens, at least in the virtual realm, since they were 7 to 8 years old. So they've literally had their brains wired differently than the earlier generations and the older cops. They are wired to shoot first, and they don't hesitate to do so. So they are literally programmed, I think, largely by video games and culture in general, to shoot first. They don't even bother with the low end of the spectrum of accelerating use of force. No, they go straight to the lethal end of it, and they fire. That's how Eric got killed. And younger cops are part of what's called the 13er. Excuse me. And this is the 13th generation of Americans in that, you know, roughly 18 to 38 age group, that 20-year span. And the 13ers are distinctly different. I didn't dream this up. It's been documented in a number of books. They range from the very smart, high-integrity people like those, you know, who founded, you know, everything from Microsoft, Apple, Facebook. But at the very lowest, most dysfunctional end of the spectrum, there are people like a lot of criminals and this 25% of the cops in that generation. So this lower end were latchkey kids that grew up pretty much on their own, parents working, and they learned very early on to lie, cheat, steal, hurt people just to survive. Now, the amazing thing is that many of this low intelligence group became cops. They're either criminals or they're cops, and psychologically there's a very thin line between the two of them. And these are extremely mean, and a lot of them have absolutely no conscience. And you say, why? Because many of them were drug babies. Mama was taking drugs when she was pregnant, and my wife was a social worker, and she saw this time and again. These kids that were started being born roughly, you know, 18 to 38 years ago, these were the ones that could chop off the tails of cats and were sticking puppies in the microwave and never even had an ounce of conscience. A lot of those are wearing badges and carrying guns now. So how does a community or a nation cure this epidemic of corrupt killer cops? Well, in some places, the Department of Justice, the FBI, they will step in and they'll clean house, and they force the police department to operate under a federal consent decree for 10 to 15 years. That happened in the Rampart Division in Los Angeles, for instance. And at one time, Las Vegas Metro was under a consent decree. But it's not going to happen in Nevada again, as I see it. And that's because you've got corrupt political figures, starting from the very high levels of politics there, right through the billionaires who control every facet of Las Vegas' economy. So they profit from corruption, and they use the cops as the modern mafia's enforcers. And you say, oh, that sounds so outlandish. Well, it happens. That's why I went to fiction, because unless you put this into context and show not only the facts of what happens, but how you get there from there, the mentality of the people involved. So in the permit, the Black World Bunch, the Checkmate guys, this team is given a mission and a mandate from the very top to force Las Vegas to clean up Metro and to root out the cartel of corruption. So Checkmate starts taking out bad cops, starting with those who killed Eric Steele. And again, they use these advanced weapons. They're designed to instill fear and doubt. I'll just give you a taste of some of the weapons that I'm using in this book. Some little tiny missiles that can take out a single guy, a high-power laser, some really horrible diseases, such as one called fatal familial insomnia. And basically, if you have that disease, you have these deformed proteins called prions, and you cannot sleep. And after a while, the body just literally burns out. It's a real disease. And so if you can weaponize that particular thing, you can inject it into people under other pretenses, and they literally flame out because they just cannot sleep. Then they use electronic systems that can remotely trigger heart attacks and strokes. And people may chuckle at that, but that technology is out there now, can be used. It's being used right now to take out high-value targets in certain areas. I mean, you can't tell the difference between a real heart attack and stroke and one that's induced from remotely.
Oh, my God. And then I've
got systems that can take control of a car, from a drone overhead and ram it into a bridge abutment. Think about it. Cars are electronics now, right? They're mostly computers. Controls, electronic ignition. It controls injection, fuel injection. In many cases, there's a computer involved in the steering, the braking, etc. So if you can take over that car remotely from a drone overhead, you can make it do whatever you want to, and you can wipe out the occupants pretty smartly. And then finally, I won't say much about it, but I use something I call the T-Rex system. It's a terahertz system, and it's basically a high-power microwave system from a super-classified jet that flies over Las Vegas. And what it does is pretty devastating, and that'll be revealed in some of the final chapters of the permit. So over to you, Lily, if you have any other questions.
Wow, you're listening to Bill Scott, who is the author of The Permit, a fictional story based on the real facts that surrounding his son's murder by Sheriff Gestapo Gillespie's regime in South Nevada, Clark County, Las Vegas area. And we're back. This is Tiger Lily. My special guest is Bill Scott, author of The Permit. It's a free book, and you can find it on thepermit.blogspot.com. And it's a fascinating read, I promise you guys. And it's based on the actual things that happened to his son that was murdered by the Las Vegas Metro Police Department. Bill, you're back on. What inspired your character, Haji?
Well, Haji Tazir is a character in the book that was the undercover security guy in the fictional Costco, which is I call Hose, H-O-apostrophe-S, and that was inspired by the real guy who made just one mistake after another and decided, I think he took one look at Eric, and my son was a gym rat. He lived in the gym. He was very well built. He had something like 3 to 4% body fat was all. He was a master fitness trainer. He got that certification while he was at West Point. Good-looking guy. He had a very good-looking, tall girlfriend. And I think this little undercover guy took one look at Eric and said, I will never be that guy. I will always be a loser. I will always be working for whatever he makes as an undercover guy. But I have one little bit of authority. I can call the cops, and I'm going to do it. And I think he wanted Metro to come and just sort of, you know, hassle Eric, and that's good enough. I show you, big guy, I can take care of you. You dare to bring a gun in my store, and you will pay for it. I'm sure he had no idea it would go as bad as it did, and, you know, this guy now has to live with the fact that his arrogance got my son killed. Now, does it matter to him or not? From what I've seen so far, not only does it not matter to him, he thinks it's pretty cool because he's a wannabe cop. He never will be a cop because he's just the kind of person that he can't even become a cop in Las Vegas. But because of a number of things I know that happened, as well as a few that I just made up, I created this character I call Haji Tazir. And I made him, you know, a second-generation Afghan that seemed to identify with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And even though he is totally gringo American, has never been to Afghanistan, as soon as somebody heard, and one of the managers heard that Eric was a former Army officer, then in the book, Haji Tazir makes the mental leap to the idea that, oh, if he was an Army officer, he's probably a Green Beret, and Green Berets were killing a lot of Afghans over there. So he just, that just made him very, very mad, and that's why he called the cops in the fictional story. Obviously, I'm not in the head of the guy that actually did it to my son, but I think it's all indicative of that particular personality that says, I will never amount to much, but I have this little smidgen of authority because I have this little tin god job, and boy, I can make life miserable for somebody else. So it's exaggerated, yes, in the book, but that's what fiction's all about. Your characters have to be bigger than life in order to make an impression.
Right, and you you did a masterful job of that. I'm telling you and the listeners, it is an absolute page turner, and it had a lot of really insightful stuff that I was surprised that you knew. I totally believe it because I've lived some of the stuff that you were talking about. You talked about the Mexicans and what the culture is like, you know, with the illegals and how the cops treat them and so forth. And you also talked about, you know, the women, some of the women, probably prostitutes, who hate the cops. And I'll tell you, Bill, I have a friend who went to on a ride-along, and I've been encouraged to go on a ride-along myself because I'm such a quote-unquote cop basher that I need to see what they really do. First of all, I did go on a ride-along when I was in the Marine Corps in 1981. In Oceanside, because I consider being a police officer for Oceanside PD in Southern California, and I wasn't impressed about how much they did. You know, they responded to calls. I actually did translation, you know, as the ride-alonger person because I speak Spanish. But my friend recently went on a Metro ride-along, and he told me that the driver of that police car detained 18 people during his 10-hour shift, and of those 18 people, he arrested one person, and most of the people that he detained was for jaywalking, and the person that he arrested, he detained for jaywalking, And then when he searched him, he realized that he had a warrant for his arrest for not having paid a jaywalking ticket. Are you kidding me? What do you think about that?
Oh, that's ridiculous. That shows the mentality of the 13er generation. I would bet money that this was a younger cop. And you look back in many of their backgrounds. Yes, some of them were these latchkey kids. Some of them were probably drug babies that are, you know, literally devoid of conscience. But a number of them, too, I guarantee you, they were nerds. They were the little fat kid that was picked on the playground. So they grew up full of anger and fury, and they couldn't do anything about it because they were nerds, little guys, fat kids, whatever. But they were the marginalized kids that happens in every single generation. But in this generation, for whatever reason, many of them decided, if I get a badge and a gun, I'm going to get even. Because now I can go out and harass anybody I want to and get away with it, especially if I'm in Las Vegas. Because the culture of the Metro Police Department is, you do literally what Sheriff Gillespie told all of his troops within days of my son being killed. He said, frankly, I'm not losing a lot of sleep over Cole, was his first name?
Trevon
Cole and Eric Scott. And when you guys are out there, I don't want you to think, shoot, don't shoot. I just want you to get the job done. And what was left hanging in the air is, you do the job, we'll protect you. We'll take care of you. And it starts with the sheriff, and it goes all the way down to the real thugs that are running the Police Protective Association. Those guys absolutely assume if a cop did it, it was justified. And therefore, we will go to the mat to protect them. And they are absolutely vicious. They get on the online comment pages under the news stories, and they rip up anybody and everybody. I don't go on there. I don't comment. But you would not believe how those, many of those guys, which are cops, they are police union guys, I guarantee it, and they have said some of the most horrible things about my son and about me and my family, and they've never met us. They don't know anything about us. It's just the fact that we push back on them, and that just infuriates them because most victims' families just ride off into the sunset, and that's the end of the story.
Yep, and you did some pushing back, a lot of it. And it was because of you, in my opinion, that the Las Vegas Review-Journal covered that five-part story of all of the murders that have been occurring under in Las Vegas.
Yes, the RJ and several of their reporters did just an absolutely superb job of journalism, I think. Yeah, they didn't get everything right, at least around our case. But they did a tremendous job of going back and looking at all the officer-involved shootings and other deaths, you know, some involving traffic accidents and stuff, over the years. Well, what came through loud and clear was that it doesn't matter what the cops do, they get away with it. They have forever and ever because the system is set up with the inquest system, a crooked DA, and I guarantee you, it all starts with the big money there. Because the cops are the enforcers, and the DA answers to the billionaires, and they all take care of each other to keep the money flowing. Now, how do you stop that? Well, the best way to stop it is people stop going to Las Vegas. If you stop going to Las Vegas and spending money, the whole place would turn into a dusty old desert town, and there'd be tumbleweeds blowing down the strip because everything is closed. That would stop it. Now, is that going to happen? Probably not, because people still plan to go there and have fun. But, you know, if I were to wave a magic wand and say, clean up Las Vegas, that's how I'd do it. Nobody would ever go there again to spend another dime. In the absence of that, the best I could do was write a story that I call The Permit, and I put it online. It's not all out there now. As you said, Lily, there's 8 chapters plus a preface there. So there's 9 elements of the story already out there. But I put up a new chapter every Friday. It's a serialized book, and it's going out one chapter at a time. I'm almost finished writing the book. I have just a few more chapters to go. And at some point, I will publish it as a electronic book, an e-book, and hopefully my publisher will pick it up and we'll turn it into a, quote, real book that will be sold in bookstores. But the intent is to do exactly what you do every week, several times a week, Lily, and that is to alert people to this particular threat to freedom. And I honestly believe, and I have lived the nightmare by losing a tremendously talented, productive, outstanding character son, and I lost him to a bunch of thugs and killers that to this day are running around free out there. I mean, they get to go home every night. They get to interface with their families. And do they lose any sleep? I doubt it, because their boss, the sheriff, told them he's not going to lose any sleep, so why should they?
Right.
So the people that killed my son are going to kill again unless we find a way to stop them. I'm using the talents that God gave me is to write a story that will hopefully wake people up. And a lot of people say, well, why don't you just do this as nonfiction? Well, it gets to the question you answered before the break, or asked me before the break. You know, you can get sued for naming names, and then you have to prove every single thing. Well, some of these things I can't prove until the day that some cop gets scared enough and he's going to start talking. That'll happen. Because if they don't, a lot of them are going to go to prison, and not just over my son's death, but others too. So in the absence of that, I can write a fiction story that's got a lot of the facts in it. I just don't tell the reader what's factual and what's fiction. I leave it up to you to decide what is and what isn't. And yes, for at first I was having a lawyer take a look at every single thing. But I know from being a journalist what falls under the rights of the First Amendment. And I also have a couple of very good author friends, some of which are, very wealthy, and they made a good living writing books. Some of those are also lawyers, and they really helped me a lot in saying what you can and can't do. Now, will that stop me from getting sued? Maybe not, but I guarantee you they won't win. And I am going to have this book out there, and it's going to hopefully go a long ways to waking up the people in Las Vegas and saying, the next time that one of these killer cops gets out there and panics like Bill Mosier did, it could be my son, my daughter, my wife, my husband, who is in front of that damn gun when it goes off and it kills them too. So at some point, we've got to get these killer cops off the street. And all I'm trying to do is raise the flag and wave it hard so that people will notice. And you're doing the same through your activism and through your radio shows. And frankly, for all your listeners, Lily, I applaud you greatly, because what you are doing takes, as much, if not more, courage than what I do, because you're going into the lion's den on a regular basis and facing the hungry lion over and over.
Well, thank you, Bill. Yeah, what I do is very jealous. And at one point, I was just so dismayed and so disappointed in my country, basically. It was like somebody told me Santa doesn't exist. It was like reliving that all over again. It's like, how in my country have we become a police state like we are? And then I'm doing some research, and the more research I do, the more depressed I get. And I thought, well, you know what? I could just get on my motorcycle and just have an adventure and go up to Canada, Alaska, go down all the way to Argentina. And then the game changer for me was when my daughter, my gorgeous daughter, who's living in San Antonio, and I'm in San Antonio visiting her for my grandchild's one-year-old birthday pretty soon. She got pregnant, and that was the game changer. So it's not just about me anymore, or my old man, or my kids. It's now I have a grandchild, and actually two of them, and I want to at least attempt to make a difference before I go out of this world. And And I know what I do is very dangerous, and I am much more likely to be killed by one of them than by a criminal, in my opinion, because I've got a gun, I show it, I'm a flaming open carrier, and every time I get detained, I say, did you guys learn nothing from Eric Scott's case? Did you not get training from the open carriers on the strip? And I shame them. I tell them, I ask them, did you swear an oath to the Constitution? Are you kidding me? Do you really believe that what you're doing to me is constitutional? And, you know, sometimes I get them to think, but most of them are just drones. But going back a little bit to the case of my friend that was riding along, my friend David Stillwell is a very hardcore activist, probably one of the top two hardest core activists in the state of Nevada. And he is in contact with the undersheriff out there. And it was the undersheriff that assigned him the police officer that was going to ride along with him. And so we think that he selected the most competent person as opposed to the least competent person, somebody that, you know, that isn't going to violate people as much. And so what was the moral of the story? That they have nothing better to do. They're so overstaffed that they have nothing better to do than to bully the homeless and bully the jaywalkers and give silly tickets out. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think you're exactly right. And it always starts at the top. It starts with leadership. I mean, I was an Air Force officer. My son, Eric, was an Army officer. He was a platoon leader of tanks. My other son, Kevin, was an Army officer. And we were all trained how to lead people. And unfortunately, Sheriff Gillespie is anything but a leader. As I heard one of his cops tell me, the only thing that Gillespie was good at was counting paper clips. And he was a dyed-in-the-wool devotee of the system. They knew that he would perpetuate the system that had been put in place long ago. In other words, he would do the bidding of those that pull the strings. So that's why he is sheriff now. But believe me, I have learned so much about what goes on in that Metro Police Department that I guarantee you, every one of those guys that raised their hand and swore to protect and serve, very few of them do it. I've mm-hmm. met a number of them that do. Some of the more courageous ones came to my son Eric's memorial service on the 17th of July.
That did take courage.
And some of them were retired. And some of them, I'll never forget this, one white-haired guy that came up, shook my hand. He took my hand in both of his. And there were tears in this guy's eyes, this older man. And he said, Mr. Scott, I just want to tell you I'm a retired Metro cop. And I have to tell you that we're not all like that, the ones that killed your son. He said, our police department nowadays is, quote, out of control. And I heard those three words time and time and time again. Our police department are out of control. Well, that all starts at the top. It's leadership. And in the Metro's case, there is no leadership. There's nothing but dictatorship. And I cannot tell you how many cops I know that absolutely hate Gillespie. 32 of them retired, most of them senior, of course, last year because they couldn't take living under Gillespie and the very crooked tower any longer. Well, I like to think that that whole cadre of killers is under the gun now. I like to think that the Department of Justice is doing a serious investigation and the whole house of cards is coming down soon. Over to you, Lily, for wrap-up.
Well, I'm very skeptical about that last comment because I happen to know that Sheriff Gillespie is part of Homeland Security, so he's in bed big time with the feds. So it's a very tight clasp that they grasp that they have over the control and domination over us citizens in Nevada. But this is not just a Nevada bill, and what I'm saying, what I'm reading here, really applies. Maybe not as much because of you've got your casinos and your that sort of thing, but it does apply all over the country and any. In the bigger metropolitan areas with the cover-ups and the silliness. I was on my motorcycle in New Mexico the day before yesterday, I think it was, and this cop told me, you know, I flagged him down to ask him about the open carry law, and there in New Mexico, because I had an encounter with a business owner, not a bad encounter, but something that I wasn't 100% sure about, and he asked me what I was wearing on my eyes, and I told him it's a camera. Of course, I'm not telling him it's spyware and I'm recording you. You know, I told him it's a camera and that I like to record. I mean, I like to take snapshots as I ride on my motorcycle of the pretty scenery and stuff, and that's true. And then he started telling me that if I, you know, and I told him that I also am an activist, and he said, if you really want to get some bad cops, you should go to Albuquerque. And he told me the story of a couple of Albuquerque cops that were pulling over women, hot-looking women, and making them expose themselves in order to avoid getting a ticket. And one of them was fired. And I says, well, it just goes to show there's just crap going on everywhere. So I think your book needs to be a movie. Have you considered that?
Oh, of course, and I have had a number of people say that they will definitely look at it as a possibility of making a movie. There's already going to be a documentary made based on Eric's case. It'll be much broader than just one case, but that'll be nonfiction. It's a documentary. We do have a movie being made of one of our other books, the Space Wars book. It's well into the process now. Script is pretty much finalized and looking for a director right now. So the fact that we have a little bit of a track record there, hopefully that'll make a difference. We'll have some serious movie makers take a look at the permit once it's all finished, published, and out there. Yes, I agree. Movies are the best way to reach the largest number of people across all strata, and I would definitely love to have it turned into a movie someday, and if it's good enough, maybe it will be.
I'm very impressed, Bill. I mean, it is. I don't know how you got into your you were very masterfully got into your son's head to describe what he must have been feeling and his thoughts and how his spirit left his body and how he's looking over. I mean, it was just, I'm getting chills just thinking about how masterfully you did that. I can't say enough good things about the permit, and I can't wait to see Chapter 9. What is coming up on Chapter 9?
I call Chapter 9 the kind of the cornerstone of the whole book, Lily. That's where my checkmate director, Gray Manor, has to be convinced that the operation to start cleaning things up nationwide, called Operation Gold Shield, that's where his boss has to justify doing these or taking these drastic measures. And he is a former Marine Corps general, has to be convinced. So it's a very tense justification process, if you will, by Todd Bright, who is a Department of Homeland Security executive, and he has to convince this former general that this is the way it has to go. So it has a lot of statistics in there about cops, many of the things I just told you today, and hopefully it will resonate with an awful lot of people that says, whoa, I don't know what's going to happen from here on, but I see why now. And a lot of things I haven't even covered today, you know, that are outlined in Chapter 9 as to why this seems to be the only way to clean up and head off major, major catastrophe all the way across the United States. Because I'll just give you a quick tidbit. when people hate their cops, like they do in Las Vegas, like they may do in Albuquerque, they no longer report crimes. Well, that's exactly the kind of,
yep,
of environment that these Mexican gangs, the one that are chopping off heads in Mexico, that's what they look for. They're already infiltrating the United States. That's fact. They're well ensconced in a number of major cities. I know Oklahoma City is one of them that's fighting these guys. Las Vegas is another one. And because they know that Las Vegas is as corrupt as they come, so it's very easy for them to move in. And doesn't matter what they do, a lot of people are going to not call the cops. I can't tell you how many folks have told me after what happened to my son, they said, I don't care what's going on. As long as nobody's getting killed, I am not calling the cops, because Metro cops screw it up 9 times out of 10 and somebody dies. All it takes is for them to say, oh, the guy pulled a gun, we had to kill him. Whether there's a gun there or not, they will put one there with what they call a throwdown. A lot of these cops carry throwdown guns. And then, of course, Captain Cover-Up is quick to show up on the scene, stand in front of the TV cameras and say, well, the guy pulled a gun, we had to kill him. That's
he
what
lied.
They did to my son, and my son had nothing more than a BlackBerry cell phone in his hand, but they tried to make it out as if he actually pulled his gun out of his waistband, which, by the way, is physically impossible. It could not be done with that particular inside the waistband holster and gun inside of 2 seconds. Can't be done. Not with one hand. We had on the order of 25 to 30 witnesses that came forward and gave formal statements to us that have never been aired, that we were going to use them in our lawsuit. And, of course, they have not been heard yet. So that was as a result of the billboard campaign where we said, you know, please call this number if you were there and you saw it. Well, the cops put out the same request, and some people came forward to talk to them. But many of the people who came to us said, I will never talk to Metro because I don't trust them. I do not trust them.
You are listening to Freedomizer Radio, where freedomizers freedomize freedom.
And we're back. This is Tiger Lily on freedomizerradio.com. We're talking to Bill Scott, and we have a caller in the area code 702. His name is Chris, and Chris, you're live. Welcome.
Hello there. Hello, Lily and Mr. Scott. My heart goes out to you for the loss of your son under these egregious perversions of the militarization of the Metropolitan Police Department Incorporated.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it, Chris.
There are many things that you must know about your son's case and the unfortunate legal realities that exist here in this corrupt judicial state that's one of the top 10 judicial hell holes in the nation, West Virginia being the number one slot holder. But there is no justice in Nevada because of the cabal that owns the justice system, the American Trial Lawyers Association, what they term the coroner's inquest, styled after the Spanish Inquisition, is really a county operation to do pre-discovery and to mitigate the damages that are exposed by the evidences that are given under this pre-discovery testimony scheme, so they can limit the liabilities of the county and protect their own fiduciary private for-profit interests. The Metropolitan Police Department is a private foreign-owned corporation. It's listed on Dun & Bradstreet. Sheriff Bill Gillespie, the elected representative of the people, the highest official in the land that's elected here in Nevada, is merely the administrator or manager of the corporation, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department Incorporated, and uses his corporate shield of immunity that he believes he has, although whenever you become negligent and malfeasant and your dereliction of duty, you then are outside the scope and color of law, and you too are then subject to being held accountable to the law, but it will not be in the state courts, I guarantee you, I regret to say.
Chris, hold on. Bill, are you familiar with like, if you would have sued Metro, what pot would that have come out of?
Well, as I understand, Metro is what they call self-insured. So basically, they tap the taxpayer, and you know, every dime that they have has to come from tax revenue. So they build into their budget process a slush fund, basically, to pay for any lawsuits for their malfeasance. And at one time, they had quite a sizable one, but they said they had to dip into that for operating expenses, et cetera. But probably the most egregious thing, besides what Chris said about the coroner's inquest process, which, by the way, when I first heard about it, I said, somebody is not telling me the full story. This just cannot exist in the United States of America, because the Clark County coroner's inquest process was a clear violation of due process by any standard known to Americans. And I just couldn't believe that it could exist in this country. It was totally one-sided. Only the DAs get to present evidence, call witnesses, question witnesses. And the other side, the victim's family side, cannot even have an attorney that even opens their mouth. All that the victim's family can do was write out questions, hand them to the bailiff, who hands them to the judge, who sometimes isn't even a real judge, and he decides whether to read them in front of the jury or not. So the DA totally stacks the deck. They can create any kind of image they want by asking any of the questions they want of the witnesses. They can cherry pick witnesses, and they did in our case. There were women there that were elderly, and they clearly had been in shock. They didn't even get the geometry right. They had Eric's back to the main wall, and that wasn't the case. He had his back to the parking lot when he was shot. And some people thought that the whole thing lasted 5 minutes. It lasted 2 seconds before Mosier fired. And then the other two officers opened up, you know, a beat or two later and put 5 more rounds in my son's back after Eric was on the ground and dying. The first round hit Eric in the heart, 45 hollow point round, and exploded Eric's heart. So these other guys firing away had no idea why they were doing it, why Mosier had fired. They just opened up because they're part of the 13ers. You know, hey, let's get some of this, you know. So as one witness said, that it was nothing more than gratuitous violence. But the coroner's inquest process was an absolute joke, believe me. And that the whole system is set up all the way down through the slush fund that pays off anybody that does win or settle with Metro. But, you know, in federal law, the police unions have done a fantastic job of convincing lawmakers that they need special protection, that cops need special protection from frivolous suits. So they stuff something into the law called qualified immunity. The bottom line of qualified immunity, which is why we had to drop our suit, is if there's any question at all about witnesses. I mean, we could have 20-some witnesses that said Eric never touched his gun, never made a move towards it, and that he had a BlackBerry in his hand. But if the cops had 3 or 4 witnesses that said, oh, yeah, I saw him reach for his gun, pull his gun, even in the holster, that's enough. That's enough for the federal courts to say, okay, we tipped the scales in favor of the cops under qualified immunity provisions. It's an absolute travesty of justice. You put that on top of the coroner's inquest process in Clark County, and real people don't have a chance, basically. The cops get away with murder, and they know it, so they don't even hesitate to shoot.
Yep. That is where we are in America. I want to thank Chris for calling, and I muted him just because I'm not so skilled to juggle so many callers at once. But, Chris, I want to tell Bill that Chris asked me to give Bill his phone number. I jotted it down, and I will give it to Bill, Chris. So I wanted to talk about the many, many spectators. When I saw that in your book, it reminded me of a friend who has a housekeeper who witnessed firsthand the killing, and she said Eric was absolutely innocent. She swears by it, but she's too chicken to come forth and talk about it. And you know, we need people to be courageous, like those Metro cops that showed up at the funeral. That really had to have taken some guts to do that. So, do you know of any? And I did see a man. I don't know if he was Hispanic or maybe Middle Eastern, but he came out and he came out on one of the news stations and was talking about what he saw. And he said that what he saw contradicts what Gillespie was saying, what the drones were saying.
Yes.
Do you recall who that was? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I remember the gentleman. I don't recall his name right now. He was a Hispanic gentleman, and I really applaud his courage because he did step forward right in front of the TV camera and said, Eric did not do anything. And the narrative that the cops were putting out, he said, was an absolute lie. And, you know, we know for a fact that when Eric's body went into the ambulance, that Eric's gun was still in its holster, still inside the waistband. And yet the narrative that the cops presented at the inquest hearing, including photos, were Eric's BlackBerry was on the concrete and Eric's gun was on the concrete, still in the holster. Now you say, now how did it get from his body in the ambulance back on the concrete? Well, because when the ambulance crew found it, they gave it to the cop that was on board, and they quickly raced it back and put it on the concrete. But they did such stupid things, Lily. When you look at the photos that were shown at the inquest process, and they're official photos in the 1,472-page official investigation report, the BlackBerry is on the concrete, the gun inside the holster is on the concrete. But get this, there is no blood on the concrete. When they moved Eric's body, there was a pool of blood there. So before the homicide team got there and before they started taking homicide, crime scene photos, somebody came out and cleaned up the blood.
Wow.
I mean, they're just that blatant, you know. And, of course, you know, why did they move the body? Eric soaked up 7 rounds. He was dead. No, somebody very quickly said, oh, my God. The gun is still in the waistband. Quick, get the body out of here. So they basically said to an EMT, you're finding signs of life, right? And the guy said, oh, yeah, I get it.
Oh, my God.
Quick, run him off to the hospital. They get him to the hospital. I mean, there is no end to the corruption. They get into the hospital. They slice him open. They ram stuff in his body, all kinds of chemicals and stuff to, quote, try to keep him alive. His heart was shattered. There were no signs of life. And guess this, University Medical Center is part of the county there, right?
Mm-hmm.
They charged us over $20,000 for life-saving measures.
Did you tell them to go pound salt?
Well, fortunately, there is at least one good commissioner on the county, and she took care of it, Chris G. Once I told her about it, she said, forget it. I will take care of this. And then some of the rest of it, like the ambulance and that sort of stuff, that went to Eric's insurance and it was taken care of. But, I mean, it's like we can kill your son and then we can turn around and stick the knife in you and twist it by charging you $20,000 for life-saving measures administered to a man that had been dead within seconds of when he hit the ground. I mean, what kind of blatant corruption does that take? There is no end to it in Las Vegas. And unfortunately, Lily, you're exactly right. This corruption extends throughout the United States. It's a different world than I grew up in. I mean, when Eric raised his hand, my son Kevin raised his hand, I raised my hand. Both, you know, my father-in-law and my dad raised their hand. And we all swore to protect the Constitution of the United States. Not the government of the United States, the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We did not stand up and swear to protect a corrupt system like we have now throughout this country. And, of course, the front line of corruption are these rogue and bad cops that are killing more Americans today than Al-Qaeda has since 9/11 on our own soil. We've got to do something about it, and we all do what we can when we can. And I appeal to all of your listeners. Find some way to get involved. Listen to Lily. Listen to the other activists that are telling you what can be done. Write to your congressman and vote, for God's sakes. We got to get rid of these people who are stealing our country away from us.
It's just appalling what they're doing, Bill. And, you know, you mentioned that your son was taken to UNC. That rings very similar, very familiar with Teresa Smith's story. Did you hear how what happened to her when her son was shot and murdered there on the spot?
I do, but you know it better than I do.
Okay. Well, what happened is that the cops, of course, controlled the information. So they told the media that he was rushed to a hospital because he was in critical condition. And Teresa Smith went to the hospital and was waiting. And one of the nurses said, "I don't know why these cops do this all the time. He's not even here. He's in the morgue. He never came up here." So she insisted on seeing her son's body, and she took pictures. And there were so many bullets through him that there is no way he could have even survived. So the cops absolutely lied to the media, and the media controlled the message. It wasn't that somebody was killed by a cop. It was that an undercover cop killed an ex-parolee. So, so they completely, defamed him, and who cares if he was an ex-parolee? He was at the time a law-abiding citizen, and when I asked him what he had been convicted for, it was a drug charge, which he pled down or negotiated for aggravated assault, and they gave him, I think, I don't know if months or a year or whatever he spent. But my friend, the activist, David Stilwell, he says that the reason they do that aggravated assault is to take away their any opportunity in the future to own a gun. So this is what they're doing in America. They are stripping us of our rights at every turn, using every, and you were talking about how we swore an oath to the Constitution. I, too, because I was in the Marine Corps. But I'll tell you what, these days I have to be very deceitful to them just to keep myself safe. When I was it was in Laughlin, there was. I was taking pictures of somebody getting violated, four people in a truck, and I was taking pictures, and these satanic, demon-like cops, they were so annoyed that I was doing that, but because I did the picture taking, they let them go, and they hadn't done anything wrong anyways, and then they detained me. So I said, "What for what?" And they said, one of them said, "For taking a picture of a minor," and one of them was 17, and the others were over 18, and it was a horrific experience, and I made a great big scene, Bill. I mean, I started screaming, saying, "My rights are being violated," and I got all these people to circle me, and because of that scene that I made, there were cameras around, and people were kind of gingerly looking. One guy got a little bit too close, so they handcuffed him because he said, "You're my hero," and they handcuffed him and put him behind the car. They had me standing straight in front of the car. I did a internal affairs complaint, and I was told, we looked into it, and I even showed them pictures and the audio. and I was told we found that he violated no policies. And if you don't agree with it, you can go to the Citizens Review Board, which is all appointed by Sheriff Gillespie. So what is incestuous relationship is that?
Well, I would encourage you to take a hard look at Chapter 9 of the permit when I post it this coming Friday, because the ramifications of that kind of behavior by our police departments are really horrendous. And that particular discussion takes place as part of the dialogue in Chapter 9, that if the cops continue to do those sorts of egregious, aggravated assaults on citizens, they are literally signing their own death warrants, and unfortunately there's going to be a lot of good cops that die at the hands of gangs and even outraged citizens at some point. I mean, we are so close to outright rebellion, and it's caused by a number of things, of course, but it's aggravated by these arrogant, we can get away with anything cops and the mentality and culture that has been put in place by crooked cops like Sheriff Gillespie. And unfortunately, when it all blows up, and that's what Chapter 9 talks about, if this, this, and this happens, we're going to have an outright war, not just riots, an outright war on our hands, and a lot of very good cops are going to die, and they don't deserve to. So it behooves we as citizens, as well as the leadership of these police departments, to get a handle on the corruption and get rid of the killer cops, because it's the only way they're going to make it, and it's the only way we're going to restore justice and freedom to this country, I think.
Absolutely. And I am at the bottom of my time, and so I want to thank you very much, Bill, Scott, for joining me and for talking about this to my audience. You're a total hero in my book. You're doing so much. The system really is quite fragile if enough people take the time and exercise the few remaining rights we even have left. And I think one of the only ones we have left is probably our First Amendment. And that's why I blog and I videotape and I expose. And exposing is very, very effective because they hate it. I know they've had meetings about us. You know, I just know it. So anyways, okay, there's the next show host is ready, and thank you very much for tuning in, everybody, and thank you very much, Bill, for being my special guest today, and I want to apologize to area code 646, but I did run out of time, but please send me a note on the chat, and I look forward to the book, the Chapter 9, and everybody get on the permit.blogspot.com, and I'll post that on the chat as well. Have a great night, everybody, and I'll see you guys tomorrow at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Thank you, Bill. Good night.
Thank you. Bye.